Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. And so he's not gone yet. The typical intermediate step, the board of a big public company and a high-profile company in that, CBS, wants to take in the wake of the allegations against its head, Les Moonves. Moonves.
Mike Scott knows, because Mike Moonves. Scott's not happy.
Yeah, he needs another E to be Moonves, like Jason Voorhees.
Moonves. All right, we'll go with Moonves.
So he's... he's not gone yet.
It's unbelievable. Charlie Rose, they gave him one night and they canned him. Everybody's been canned in a day. Matt Lauer, everyone. And why does he get a pass? I mean, not only is he allegedly accused of forcing himself, sticking his tongue down people's throats, touching them under their skirts. Also, 30 current and former CBS employees described a culture of gender discrimination at the network with men being promoted over women.
Pull the reins and pump the brakes. Do both. People all using this opportunity to say I got passed over by a man is off topic. We're talking
about it's part of the New Yorker piece.
Well, I understand it's part of the New Yorker piece because there's a larger political agenda here. But in terms of predatory behavior, criminal behavior, we're talking about potentially criminal behavior here.
Right, but he's the CEO of CBS, so he's the man in charge. And people said that they've complained, and their complaints were not responded to well. And I think it's part of it. I'm just surprised that he's still there.
What's part of it?
That he, because of the fact that there's 30 employees who describe this culture of gender discrimination, I think that that's part of this man being a monster. Because he thinks that he could have what he wants and touch what he wants and promotes what he wants because he's the CEO. And yesterday, his wife on the talk, still defending him.
I issued the one and only statement I will ever make on this topic on Twitter. And I will stand by that statement today, tomorrow, forever.
Well, I guess Julie Chen, who's an employee of CBS, is not one of those. She's not one of those making those claims of gender discrimination, blah, blah, blah. The blah, blah, blah is when people try and leverage an incident to prosecute their own cases. Maybe there's examples of it. I want to see specifics. Culture of gender discrimination isn't compelling to me. That sounds like a political statement. The specific incidents in question, however, completely different matter. And so, the board of CBS is, as I said, taking the intermediate step, bringing the outside counsel. What same thing CPS is doing. Who's been fired at CPS? I mean, other than those people that have already been convicted of crimes.
The molesters, yeah.
Who's been fired at CBS
fired
in the hierarchy?
Volunteers. Not one person.
So where's the screeching about the board at CPS, about any particular principal at any particular school where some of these incidents have occurred or even alleged to have occurred, since, as you point out, people are fired all the time for in the basis of credible allegations, even if they haven't been substantiated or proven. So where's that? It's very selective, aren't we? Easy target. I have no use for this Les Moonves guy. Another entertainment scumbag, entertainment industry scumbag. Oh, I'm shocked. How about the Chicago Public School System?
One principal was fired. Ooh.
Two were moved around.
Yeah, some were moved around. Yeah. One was let go and then rehired in Florida.
And we're talking about adults with responsibilities over children We're not talking about adults and adults in a corporate setting. So which is more egregious? Not that you want to get into this competition, but in terms of who do these adults have a duty to protect? Children, special needs children, versus adults in a corporate setting. And we've talked about these cases too. I also want to hear from the women who were accosted by Moonves and their career suffered as a result of not complying with his predation.
Well, one woman, Elaine Douglas, she claims that she didn't get key roles because she denied his advances and that he forcibly pushed her to the ground and kissed her.
Yeah. That doesn't surprise me.
But he did some of this work he did in the boardroom with other people in the room.
That's what's alleged. And here we go again. Boy, too. The high-profile men accused of this, everything from boorish to criminal conduct. Hollywood, entertainment, media. Boy, all these feminist men. You know, these feminist men in entertainment, media, sports, feminists. They're like fiscal conservatives in Illinois. They're all feminists, and they couldn't be more at odds with who they say they are. I mean, stop with the feminists. You're killing us. Stop with the fiscal conservatives. You're killing us in Illinois. Everybody's a fiscal conservative, the worst-run state in the nation. And the question we've asked before, too, over the course of the last year that all of these Me Too stories have emerged, when does this visit itself in high-profile corporate settings? So this is sort of the intersection of the two at CBS. But what about big banks, Wall Street banks? Oh. What about big law firms? There's a really good piece in the Wall Street Journal about just that. At law firms, rainmakers accused of harassment can switch jobs with ease. Oh. The flowers arrived at Mayor Brown days after a prized new hire started at the law firm's New York office. Thanks for taking him. The note on the bouquet read, it was signed, The Women.
Oh, that's spectacular.
Mayor Brown had begun getting calls earlier about James Tannenbaum, veteran capital markets attorney. They learned he left his previous firm, Morrison and Forster, in December after sexual harassment allegations. Tannenbaum resigned the next week from Mayor Brown shortly after the firm began an investigation. It wasn't the first time he had switched jobs. Before Morrison Forster hired him in 2003, soon after he paid a settlement to a female lawyer who accused him of sexual harassment at his longtime firm Strock and Levon. So the point, and they give other examples, law firms stand out in a corporate landscape where rainmakers accused of bad behavior often receive second and third chances. According to interviews that the Wall Street Journal did with lawyers, dozens of lawyers, legal recruiters, consultants, and leaders some of the country's largest law firms. And another guy, Jeffrey Reeves, Gibson, Dunn, and Crutcher partner, departed in December after an investigation into sexual harassment allegations. He was the partner in charge of the firm's Orange County, California office in October 15 when coworkers saw him making out with the junior associate at a Las Vegas nightclub during an office retreat, said current and former lawyers at the firm. In August 2017, so 2 years later, Reeves called a female associate into his office after going to lunch with her and having several glasses of wine. He locked the door, dropped his pants, pushed her into a chair, put his hand on the back of her head, and made her perform. She emerged crying after partner knocked repeatedly on his office door. He, of course, denies the allegations.
Oh, of course.
But they were investigated and ultimately led to his departure. So, you know, other industries where bad actors are being held to account. That's the good part about the Me Too movement.
Well, Ronan Farrow said that he's working on a number of other high-profile executives in the media business and elsewhere. So he's on this. But, I mean, it's got to be in everywhere. If it's CPS, if it's at law firms, you know it's there's more heads that are going to roll.
Well, consistent characteristic? What do you see over and over again?
Men in powers of position taking advantage of women.
Right, but...
And if they don't comply, then their world is turned upside down.
There's a culture around it, is the point. Men are taking advantage of men, in some cases, Kevin Spacey. there's a culture around it. You are not accountable. There are no rules. You are a man without a chest. You are just to feed your appetites. That's the culture we push. I'm nothing but my appetites. My libido.
There's no self-control. Or boundaries.
The social mores.
Yeah.
There's no standard of conduct. I'm to feed my appetites at whatever the cost because I'm me and I'm living my truth.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. We're talking about Les Moonves at CBS and more of the Me Too movement. Moonves being investigated by an independent counsel that's being retained by CBS. So his time is short. His days are numbered. But the corporate, the CBS board is going through the, you know, the protocols. Pete in Montgomery, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy. Listen, I don't believe in moral equivalency, but I do have a question as to where women's behavior falls into this discussion as well. Because even in my work career, I've had experiences of women wearing provocative clothing and trying to sleep their way to the top. So, I mean, where does that fall into this?
Dan.
A reversal of the same thing.
Yeah.
Well, what line of business are you in?
Well, I'm a carpenter.
Oh.
Okay. Thanks for the call, Pete.
Jesus was a carpenter, too.
I've heard that. Story is going to go about women sleeping their way to the top in the carpentry industry, but I don't want to hear the stories. I know that.
Well, I mean, they can be carpenters. Do you know any female carpenters? I mean, Mike?
I'm sure there are.
Yeah, right? Sure.
Mike Scott does.
What's her name?
He's like Mike Scott's like Mike.
What?
Rowe.
There's one. There's just one.
He knows females.
Oh
in every
my gosh!
Industry.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying
okay,
I don't...
women who are in carpentry. Amy Jacobson needs a call.
Good for them.
What about so women who are, you know, quote unquote social climbers within the corporate sector? What about women?
Oh,
who...
yeah. No, there's women out. Trust me. I know that there's women out there who've slept their way to the top.
Yeah. Go ahead. Start naming them. You don't want to be running Pharaoh?
It's going to
be your big break.
I am responsible for my behavior only, and I've never done anything like that.
A tweet from Kevin Rooney. Ronan Farrow seems to have a grudge against big shot men in the entertainment industry. Gee, I wonder where that comes from. Yeah, nicely done.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
If you're talking about it, I'll be talking about it. Dennis Prager here. Join me this morning at 11, right here on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. So four feudal lords on Chicago City Council, four of the 50, want mayoral candidate Willie Wilson, who we've had on the show a number of times.
Yeah.
Big fan of Willie Wilson. Want him arrested and charged with a class felony?
Yeah, they said that, you know, according to the 1970 Illinois Constitution, Article 7, that Illinois state law prohibits the selling of one's vote for a promise of employment or any gift or loan of money or other valuable consideration, and mandates that a violation of this law shall be guilty of a class 4 felony. Signed by Raymond Lopez, 15th Ward, Michael Scott, 24th Ward, Joseph Moore, 49th Ward.
Sure.
And looky who's here. Look at that. It's your buddy, 42nd Ward Alderman Brendan Riley.
Oh, yeah. You can tell his signature because it's like an X because he's always drunk. He doesn't have the hand-eye coordination to sign his name. Yeah. Well, that's great. We're going to have to lock up half of the city workforce, too, by the way, under that provision. But I appreciate the four aldermen who were strict constructionists when it comes to the Illinois Constitution.
In case some of you don't know, he handed out $300,000 worth of cash at a church a few weeks ago. And he did it. He said what he did with his own money, he's trying to help alleviate the burden from our high property taxes.
What I do with my own money is my own money. I mean, look, can't anybody tell me what to do with my own money?
Yeah. I think he's got a point there. According to Willie, told us when we interviewed him on the topic, didn't ask anybody for their vote. He handed out money at a church, which he's been doing for a number of years through his foundation to help people with their bills. The fact that he's a candidate is a separate and distinct matter.
And Governor Rauner just happened to be at that same church that same day, and Governor Rauner had given his foundation, I believe, $100,000.
But now that was the governor money. His money was given in check.
Yeah, and Willie Wilson brought a wad of cash. But since this story ran, I want you to know that we have a little bit of an update. Governor Bruce Rauner says he'll no longer give money to the charitable foundation of Willie Wilson.
Of course not.
He's given him a total of $200,000 in the last year alone.
That's because former Governor Rauner will fold if he gets pushed by anybody. Starting with his wife, but certainly not limited to her. I mean, that's just a fact. He's getting pushed around by fungible aldermen you've never heard of and never will. And never should, frankly. Willie Wilson?
Michael Scott before.
This is the difference. Well, I'll get to this later in the show, perhaps. Among the many differences, why one is successful and one has been a catastrophe. Trump versus Rauner. Trump, for all of his flaws and faults, you disagree with his style, challenges norms, is challenging norms, within a system that has become moribund and corrupt and illegitimate in many respects in the public's mind. Bruce Rauner pretends to want to challenge the system, and then when the protectors of the status quo mobilize, he's the first one to genuflect. He's the first one to surrender. I didn't really mean it. That's a huge difference. That's why Trump is a leader and former Governor Bruce Rauner is a failure. And Rauner, the thing they do have in common is sometimes difficulty with the truth, but Rauner lies pathologically to cover his betrayals and surrenders. Trump, you know, lies a little bit here and there to defend his own sort of business record in his personal life, attack his opponents.
Yeah. It's just they're both outsiders. They're both just successful businessmen. One made it, and one's.
Well, they both. Well, they both were never really outsiders. They both were in the system.
They were
first time candidates, outsiders in that sense. But it's not about outsider insider. That's such a phony construct. That's like the boneheads in the D.C. press corps use. Scott Walker, who's a career politician, is as much of an outsider, maverick, norm challenger, system changer as Trump is, certainly. But he's a career politician. He's an insider. These guys knew the game. They were in the game. I mean, Trump much more so than Rauner. Rauner's incompetent in addition to being complicit with the status quo here.
And just so you know, the State Board of Elections said Wilson didn't break any campaign finance laws because the money came from his foundation, not from his campaign.
And again, he wasn't saying, here's $150, make sure to vote for me in February.
Did you go Sunday to the church on Damon?
I thought you would have went. I'm good.
I was actually thinking about it. Yeah. I thought, you know what? Other people need money more than I do.
We were asking for people who know female carpenters earlier in the show. Maybe knock this one out. Rick on the West Side, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, good morning, Dan and Amy. Hey, Amy, I just want to know about female carpenters. Actually, the first carpenter was a female. It was Eve. She made Adam's banana stand.
Oh.
Stop.
All right, pretty good, Rick.
If you're a female carpenter, Colin, I've never heard that one before.
That's pretty good.
If you're a female carpenter, we're here for you all morning, 312-642-5600.
You know who to like that joke?
Who?
Willie Wilson. Sorry he couldn't be with us at present. Oh, hey, by the way, yesterday over the weekend, did you see a Tiny Dancer and Attorney General Fivehead and Eddie Johnson unveiled their the police reform plan.
Yeah.
Did you see this? 232-page draft is the first iteration of a planned consent decree that would serve as a court enforced mandate governing how Chicago police officers use force. Tiny Dancer said this draft is going to stand the test of time.
Oh, please.
Time immemorial. This will go down in the annals and annals of history. Among other things, you ready for this?
Yeah.
Speaking of system change, anonymous complaints against officers would be investigated.
Oh, really?
That doesn't open up a Pandora's box of
false accusations
and wasted time. Would require the police department to track foot pursuits. Okay. I'd like to hear more specifics on that. Yeah, I don't know. It may microchip the police officers or something so you can GPS them.
They have body cameras already.
I don't know.
You're just reading from the degree.
Limit officers' use of tasers.
Well, I don't think they use their tasers. I'm sure they do, but we just don't hear about it.
And most importantly, in furtherance of keeping the peace on the streets, use terms appropriate to people's gender identity.
Okay. So if a bad guy is pointing a gun at your face and you call him a he and she's really a she, you can get in trouble for that?
Yeah.
Don't shoot me, you.
Yeah. You're right. You have to ask their gender identity before you ask them not to shoot you.
Put your hands up, you.
Mm-hmm. So there it is. Let's see. In the last half dozen years, the Tiny Dancer's been in charge. We've had round numbers here. Sorry to be sort of callous with respect to people's deaths, but, I mean, that's the culture. What, 5,000 dead, 20,000 shot, wounded? And the response is, just to repeat, the big ideas, the big response to remake the Chicago Police Department, ostensibly for the purposes of improving public safety, but of course that's not the point. This is just this is like a political op-ed. But here's their big ideas. Again, anonymous complaints to be investigated, the department track foot pursuits, limit the use of tasers, and require police to use appropriate terms appropriate to people's gender identity.
Attorney General Lisa Madigan also said she wants to listen more to the input of anti-police groups like Black Lives Matter and the American Civil Liberties Union. So they're choosing anti-police groups over police officers.
When you said pigs in a blanket fry them like bacon, tell me more. I want to understand that. How do we translate that into public policy, into department policies and procedures? Speaking of the FOP.
Yeah, Kevin Graham had a really nice statement.
He's not as quite as excited about it as everybody else. He said it's illegal and valid and it's politically motivated. No, you don't say.
Yeah. Well, it threatens both public safety and the well-being of police officers.
Well,
don't point your gun at me.
I mean, between the shutdown of the Dan Ryan and this draft consent decree, we're good. We won't have to worry about Chicago violence anymore.
All right, move on. Nothing to see here. Please disperse. Nothing to see here. Please.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You've switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. So we're within 100 days of the midterm elections.
98 days.
Probably take stock. Are you going to vote? Are you
going to sit this one out?
Motivated to go further, even with an eye towards 2020? Are you putting together your Bill Kristol for POTUS placards? You see that Weekly Standard editor in chief?
Yeah.
Bill Kristol.
He's gonna run for president.
No plans to run, but I'm randomly in Boston today and happen to have had lunch with someone who does a lot of work in New Hampshire. As he'd say, you never know.
Okay.
According to...
Let's try to be down with the struggle there, huh?
According to some that are familiar with Kristol's thinking, he's been considering a run against Trump in the primary in 2020 for months. He's consistently said that Trump needs to face a 2020 primary challenger. Quote, we need to take one shot at liberating the Republican Party from Trump and conservatism from Trumpism. So there's some motivation for you. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. Are you in for the struggle to help Republicans keep the House, or do you just care about Trump? What's it going to be? And do you understand that one is connected to the other? Nate Cohn has a good piece in New York Times. He's the saber matrician who replaced the other geek.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. It's the 2018 midterms, not dominated by well-educated suburban districts that voted for Hillary Clinton. Instead, the battleground is broad and includes a long list of working-class and rural districts that voted for Trump in 2016. So let's just get a handle on the landscape a bit. The good news for Republicans is that the 60 most vulnerable Republican seats in total voted for Trump by 3 points in 2016. The bad news is that Democrats are holding their own in some of these districts at present. 98 days is a long time, but, you know, we're starting. People are going to be back here in August. Kids back in school. You start to pay a little bit more attention. Obviously, the sort of sprint to the finish after Labor Day, which isn't that far away. A lot of retirements for Republicans. Remember, Democrats need 23, net 23, to take control. 42 retirements by Republicans, many in solid Republican districts, but some Democrats have fielded candidates that are making it competitive. So a lot of the indicators with respect to the landscape are mixed. Trump is Republicans are not doing as well in some of these congressional districts that Trump won as he did. And just to give a few examples to make the point here, present the evidence, Nate Cohn does. Poll showing Democrats ahead in Kentucky 6th, West Virginia's 3rd, North Carolina's 9th, New York's 22nd, Montana's at-large district. Mr. Trump won each of those districts by at least 10 points. So those are the kind of districts that if they fall, you're potentially looking at not just a Democrat takeover, but maybe a wave that's still forming out at sea.
And how does it look for our friend Peter Roskam? Congressman Roskam.
Well, this is a statistical dead heat. That race is a dead heat, the last polling I saw. So that's another good example. But that
Republicans cannot stay home.
Right. But the good news is if you think the yoga vote is going to do in suburban Republicans.
Start calling it the yoga vote. Yeah. That's good. I like that, the yoga vote.
There's some evidence that, that's not the case. Certainly that's not a foregone conclusion at this point.
Well, what are you going to do? Because, who are you going to vote for governor? That's going to be on the ballot on November 6th.
Yeah, I understand. I'm talking about control of Congress.
Yeah,
that's...
But I'm just saying because some Republicans are turned off by our gubernatorial race that they won't go to the polls, and that's my concern.
That is a legitimate concern, that there's nothing exciting at the top of the ticket in Illinois. Mm-hmm. Trump is not popular in suburban Cook and the Collars. I mean, he's not as unpopular as Rahner, but who is? I mean, so you're not, are you coming out to keep Trump in power, with majorities in the House, you know what I mean?
312-642-5600 is our Turnkey.pro answer line, 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
And so it becomes a base plus issue. But you worry if there's nothing at the top of the ticket or locally that is animating Republicans, Trump voters, conservatives to come out and vote, that you're not getting the base turnout you need. This is something that Rahner hasn't understood for a long time with his pandering to the left and his betrayal of his base. If you can't turn out your base, you cannot win in competitive elections. It's a base plus environment because things are so divisive. And so that's a real concern. If I were Randy Holcrin or Peter Roskam, I'd be very concerned about that. I'd be very concerned about base turnout. If I were suburban Republican legislators, I'd be very concerned about base turnout, as well as Republican challengers to suburban Democrats. Very concerned about that. Energy and emotion matter in elections. They do. And it's interesting. There's a Byron York writes this piece about these GOP strategists he's been talking to off and on over the last several months, and how their attitudes, a couple of them, their attitudes have changed. In January, I put the odds of keeping the House at 50-50, said one strategist. June, that same strategist, was, we keep the House, I'd bet a lot of money on that. And now, after the last 30 days of the family separation policy at the border and the performance in Helsinki, I wouldn't really want to have the election today, says that strategist. And one of the things that that indicates is how fluid things are, how dynamic the environment is, which is why I say 98 days is a long time. But Republicans have been consistently at a deficit with a generic ballot. So it tells you something about landscape. Obviously, we've seen Democrats have fairly good results over the course of these special elections in the last year. So that tells you something. That's an indicator that, you know, at best, it's probably a 50-50 proposition. And so how can we improve from 50-50 to something better than that? Or how can we make sure we hold the seats that are necessary to hold? Well, perhaps it all turns on Trump's behavior. Jay Cost, writing at National Review, and Jay Cost is another guy who, you know, is really a numbers guy when it comes to talking about elections, but he makes this point. Despite his achievements, Trump is unpresidential, and that will matter to voters. The predicament for today's Republicans is not the agenda or the State of the Union. The predicament is the president himself, Donald Trump. While Trump has undoubtedly advanced the conservative agenda, he hasn't done so in a presidential manner, and style matters when it comes to people's voting. So Cost suggests that you can talk about the substantive policy choices, personnel choices Trump has made. We have often on the show, largely in support. But the style matters, and you have people that are surface skimming voters, a lot of them, fewer in midterm elections than in presidential, but nonetheless significant. And they're not going to intellectualize their vote. They're not running the traps. They're not saying, am I taking home a little bit more money than I was taking home before President Trump? Do I feel more optimistic about the country? I go back to what I referenced yesterday, Mark Shields saying, when the economy is bad, the election's about the economy. When the economy is doing pretty well, the election can be about other things. And so for GOP strategists to be trotting out the conventional wisdom, you know, these are the same people that were consultants to all of the candidates that Trump defeated. Just remember that. These, some of these GOP strategists that are as subject to groupthink as the identity politics laden left. The idea of just saying it's the economy stupid, it's your take-home pay stupid, that is necessarily going to be enough to keep the House. You may need to go, number one, it would be benefited if Trump behaved more in what people have come to expect in terms of presidential conduct. Number two, you're going to have to advance issues that have emotional appeal, in addition to intellectual appeal. So, for example, perhaps amplifying this abolish ICE or not immigration issue is a way that Republicans could drive or ignite some emotion within center-right voters the way that Ocasio-Cortez and the socialists have ignited enthusiasm among the Democrats' base, the left's base. But you're going to have to think about this more than just simply things are better, Trump's doing well, look at this policy achievement and that policy achievement, looking at this progress in deregulation, this tax cut, these appointments, and think that's going to be enough. This is not a normative question, really. Should it be? This is a positive observation. This is what the landscape suggests. And so how do you operate in the landscape as given, not what you wish it was? Greg in Schaumburg, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Okay, picking up on exactly where you're at right now, Dan, but from the standpoint of Illinois only, with the concern being that Pat Brady, and that's not a softball, but it's just literally the case, they're in la la land in the sense of where the Republican Party is. They are literally ticked off. So how do you turn them out in Illinois, given the fact that Rahner and the Republicans are not even mentioning the word Trump?
You answer your own question, Greg. What would motivate you? What do you want to hear from the party to which you affiliate?
I would want to hear the fact that Trump is a terrific president, that he's doing great things in the country, that he's speaking common sense. I don't agree with the political analyst who just said that he's not acting presidential. He's acting exactly what needs to be done to cut through, pardon me, the crap that's gone on in the political process for ages.
So you think that with respect to local races and turning out people locally for congressional races like the Hultgren and Roskam that we mentioned, as well as the state and local races, you think it's about nationalizing the races and embracing Trump?
That's why I was so disappointed.
Neither of them were there when he made his first visit as president to Illinois.
Hmm.
And I know it was near St. Louis, so what? They should have been there. They should have been on stage with them. That was a big mistake.
Rahner wasn't invited.
No, not Rahner. It's Roskam or Hultgren. They should have invited themselves. You know, they can do that.
Hey, Dan and Amy. And one other quick point. Trump is making a big mistake by not coming here a lot. He should be landing at O'Hare, in my estimation, once a month and being on a Rahm Emanuel's tail. Just saying, hey, fix it. If it's not going to get fixed, I'm coming in and I'm going to fix it for you.
Oh, all right. Thanks for the call, Greg.
I don't know about once a month.
Well, I don't know about
it. I mean, the first time, remember during the campaign, what a debacle that was at the United Center?
Where
he was supposed to speak?
UIC.
I mean, UIC, yeah.
I don't think Trump coming to Illinois, except like Southern Illinois, like he did the other day at Granite City, and Mike Boss, the congressman from down there, was with him.
Oh, good.
I don't think it, up here, or even as delicious as it would be, going after Rahm on the ground here in, you know, the Trump-free zone that is Chicago. I don't think it's helpful to midterm chances for some of these swing districts in Illinois that could ultimately determine control of the House. Because what does it do? It just motivates the base of the other side. I mean, that's really what you're doing. If Trump comes in here to antagonize, you're just giving Tiny Dancer and Chicago Democrat crime families the fodder they need to make the election about Trump rather than to make the election about how they have destroyed this state and city financially and in every other way. See, I don't think that Trump is a referendum question that turns the base out. I mean, maybe on some targeted level, but I think you have to make the Illinois race about Illinois, where people live. Ken in Lombard, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Morning, Dan, Amy. I wanted to make some commentary on things that I see in DuPage County. As far as I'm concerned, this whole Roskam race, I can't believe it's as tight as it is, that it's basically a statistical dead heat. Peter Roskam appropriates a conservative agenda with about as much tact, as much respect, and as I've seen anybody. And he does this in a way that's appealing to people, yet he's still in a dead heat. I look at DuPage County, namely on Roosevelt Road. I'm at the Trader Joe's, and I see a token Prius that somebody drives to be posh or trendy or whatever with the Obama 2012 sticker on it. And then they, in the neighborhood, they pull their car into a three-car garage in a $750,000 house with a BMW parked in it. It boggles my mind. I don't understand what these people want. It's an enigma, and I don't know how you crack that code.
Thanks for the call, Ken. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, that's sort of the yoga vote, and that's not just limited to females. That's sort of that suburban gooey yoga vote that we're talking about and that Roskam has to contend with. Mike in Crown Point.
Morning, Dan and Amy. A couple points. One, I think Republicans, Illinois, California, New York, don't waste your time. They're going to have to fall under the weight of their own problems before they ever change. Second thing is, the House can dibble back and forth. I think you're going to get beat bad, but the Senate's what they've got to worry about. They've got the Democrats have 25 seats up for grabs in Trump states. That's what's going to break it for them. If they just maintain control of the House and get a big majority of the Senate, they're done. Plus, their own party's fracturing up into leftists. I don't know if I'm 60 years old. When I was a Democrat, I don't know where I fit in. Thanks.
Thanks for the call, Mike. Tom in Deer Park.
Good morning. I'm just spitballing here. Dan, I know you get it. I heard your comments. But to some of the listeners and the callers, I live in Roskam's district here. In any off year, the resistance, the opposition party is energized. Mm-hmm. With the case of Donald Trump this year, they're ultra uber energized. They will be coming out in full force. My concern is a Roskam voter is that the MAGA crowd, which in my opinion does not know, does not care, does not want to know, does not want to care. They care about MAGA. They might not know who Peter Roskam is, and they're not going to show. And it's those voters that we need at the polls this November. So, you know, again, you understand this. I'm hearing a lot of listeners and callers and people in my neighborhood, people I've known for 15 years that don't.
Well, I think, you know, and I look, this is a challenge in political campaigns is to help people connect the dots on a range of issues. One of the issues here is if Trump is what has motivated you to participate in politics over the last couple of years and you like what he's doing, then you have to connect that dot and say, well, Peter Roskam needs to stay in the House. Randy Hulker needs to stay in the House. We have to make sure these guys win. Because without them, you don't have Republican control of the House, and not only do you blunt the Trump policy agenda, you subject the guy that you want to win re-election in 2020 to an impeachment proceeding. And so you subject the country to a circus. So I mean, I think you have to, you know, I think you just have to help people that as I said, are sort of surface skimmers, connect some dots and, you know, and motivate them to participate.
Yes. Bingo, Dan. I'm going to interrupt you because you do it. Because I'll tell you what, your typical MAGA fire breather that watches Fox, they're not paying attention to the local race. So a guy like yourself, I appreciate what you're doing. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Tom.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
I know one way to get turnout up in Ohio. For Republican candidates in Ohio.
Oh.
Run against LeBron James. LeBron James sat down with your girlfriend there.
Oh, yeah, because he opened up his school in Akron, Ohio yesterday, the I Promise school.
Yeah. Boy Toy Don That's Lemon nice sat though. Down with LeBron James, who's complained about Trump dividing the nation with sports.
We are in a position right now in America, more importantly, where this race thing is taking over, you know, and because... One, because I believe our president is kind of trying to divide us. But I think...
Kind of?
Yeah. is. Not, I don't want to say kind of. He's dividing us. And what I noticed over the last few months, that he's kind of used sport to kind of divide us. And that's something that I can't relate to because I know that sport was the first time I ever was around someone white. You know, and I got an opportunity to see them and learn about them, and they got an opportunity to learn about me, and we became very good friends. And I was like, oh, wow, this is all because of sports. And sports has never been something that divides people. It's always been something that brings someone together.
Yeah, racial politics began with Trump. Okay, dope. Here's the thing. LeBron James is right about sport. Sport's been ahead of the learning curve on a lot of issues, including racial equality. That's the good thing. But it's funny that somebody who understands that would then be a proponent of the racial politics he decries. This is the confusion of the left. They just can't set it straight. Sports is colorblind. You can either dunk or you can't. You either have a 40-inch vertical or you don't. You can either, you know, do the 40 and 4-2 or you cannot. So it's colorblind. It's a meritocracy. And then LeBron James, when he takes the uniform off, turns into Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. I wish he could connect some dots.
In that school, too, there's 171 pairs of his shoes embedded in the wall. So the kids never forget how they got here.
Yeah, I'm glad it's not a monument. LeBron James. Glad it's not a monument to him.
Well, at least he spent his money on the kiddies.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Hey, Joe Walsh here. Build the wall. No more excuses. Just build the wall. We'll talk about that when Freedom returns at 5.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Well, we were talking about the midterms. We had a few more callers on that and your level of participation, the importance of the midterms 98 days out. Before we get to yet another installment of Why I'm Single, let's go to Candace and DuPage. You're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Morning, Dan. I have a few points. I think that, you know, Prager tried to get the Republican Party, had a meeting with them early on, and he tried to get them to understand that it's all about the left. And they still, I wish Trump would dust off the speech that was given to him by Prager and give it, because people are still thinking this is about rinky dink stuff, like, you know, just about people. It's not. I mean, this is everything. If they win this, if they win the House, they're going to impeach a man who's innocent and didn't do a damn thing just because that's what their rabid base wants. People don't understand what's at stake. And then the next thing they're going to do is start importing millions of refugees. They don't care about the public. They don't care. And people don't understand that. And I wish that Donald Trump would listen and he would do a speech finally about the left.
All right.
That needs to happen.
All right. Thanks for the call, Candace. Well, I mean, I go back again to say there needs to be an emotional quotient to the content that's advanced by Republicans, that's advanced by conservatives. There's not an emotional appeal there. You're not going to fully engage the swath of voters that you need to. Bruce in Bloomingdale.
Morning, guys. How you doing?
Good.
I've been a constituent of Pete Roskin's. I heard you mention him, and I'm, you know, I'm going to vote for him. I've been politically aware and involved for 25 years, but man, he's not making it easy. I cannot pin that guy down on his position on Build the Wall. I call, I write, you know, I don't hear back from him. So I think the problem with guys like Pete Roskin is they're not giving people the motivation to get out and run. They're so scared of ticking off this mythical middle that they just simply refuse to take a stand. You know, I expect this guy to support a president who's got 92% approval with the grassroots Republicans, and I don't see it.
Yeah, Bruce, I think that's a good point. Thanks for the call. And here's the thing.
He does want border security. I mean, we've asked him.
Yeah.
But meaning not, I didn't hear him say a complete wall. I mean, walls are already up in certain cities, in certain areas, but stronger border security.
Well, here's the thing. I think Bruce's larger point is a good one, is you should lean into who you are. Be aggressive. Don't run from it. Don't try and hide from it. Don't try and kind of soft pedal it. Be who you are genuinely, warts and all, because at least people can get a feel for you and they have some understanding of who you are, what you're going to do, why you're going to do it. But when you kind of duck and run, you bob and weave, it calls into question everything you say you are and would do, even among supporters. And I think Bruce is an example of that. And I think Roskam has suffered from a little bit of that, a little bit of the bob and weave syndrome. And I think it's been to his detriment. He could easily have his own brand that transcends the brand of the party, that transcends the brand of whoever the president is. And he does to some extent, but he's diluting that, I think, some of the tactics he's used in advance of this election cycle. Let me give you an example of how this plays out. When Bruce Rauner, former Governor Bruce Rauner, consummates his defeat in November, it will be moments like this where we reflect upon. Four Republican governors refused to sign a letter supporting Brett Kavanaugh to be the Supreme Court Justice of the United States. Who do you think is included in the four?
Rauner.
Of course. Of course. Even though he said he's highly qualified and he's a distinguished jurist and
what
all the...
What is that pandering?
What do you think?
I mean,
what do you think it accomplishes?
Trying to get the Democratic vote?
What do you think it accomplishes?
Illinois? They're not voting for you. I'm sorry. They're voting for Pritzker.
But
I know. What does it?
And
no, he's pandering to the.
And I'm sorry. The governor who is a member of my party can't bring himself to support somebody he concedes. Everybody concedes because it's a fact. A highly qualified nominee to the Supreme Court of the United States. So I'm sorry. Why am I supposed to die on a hill for this guy again? In addition to everything else with Rauner, but just using this as the example. Why am I supposed to die on a hill for him?
He lied to me, so I can't vote.
Come on, Bob in Buffalo Grove.
Yeah, Dan and Amy, thanks for taking my call. Maybe you can help me out, Dan. You're talking about a lot of the Republican seats being flipped to Democratic. What are the chances of flipping a few of the Democratic seats to Republican? I'm in a gerrymandered 8th, and I still get information on the 10th because I'm, again, as I said, in the gerrymandered 8th. But Raja and Schneider do not represent me. The 10th used to be kind of the flipping back and forth.
Yeah.
Is there any chance of getting the enlightening the Republicans to point out that Raja and Schneider are off the rails on some of their views?
I think it's going to be difficult. I mean, I like Bennett, who's running against Schneider, but I don't think that race is going to be resourced, and so I just think it's going to be difficult. I mean, to give you the races we're talking about that are coin flips right now. I mean, Roskam and Hultgren, to give you a sense of how difficult the landscape is in Illinois, when those two incumbents are in, you know, facing existential political threats, I mean, that going after Raja or Schneider or Bridge is probably too far this cycle. Thanks for the call, Bob. Mike on the north side.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I'm not going to vote for Rauner. I'm going to vote for McCain. All good conservatives are going to vote for McCain. And they're going to vote for whatever Republican is on the ballot because we have to support Trump. We know what the score is. It doesn't matter whether they're conservative enough or not. We just need them to sit in that seat and protect Trump. They're wearing a uniform. That's all that matters. I don't like anybody in the White Sox bullpen, but they're wearing a uniform. I got to cheer for them. The Democrats, remember this, the Democrats want to use an activist Supreme Court to beat us down, and the Democrats under Obama and under whoever they put up in 2 years, are openly hostile to Christianity or any organized religion. Remember that. Thanks. America will disappear as we know it if the Democrats take the Congress.
Thanks for the call, Mike. All right. Well, let's come back and find out another example, another reason I am single.
Listen to podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM 560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Is it time?
On a very special Dan and Amy. Yeah, it's time. You know what it's time for? It's time for this.
Time now for another reason why Dan Puff is single.
So I'm having this discussion with a friend of mine about, and she's recounting how a friend of hers just gave birth to their second child.
They gave birth to this. She didn't. The couple gave birth to their second child.
No. If the child came from the woman.
Okay.
It wasn't a joint exercise. And this is exactly the jumping off point for the conversation. So it was the husband was in the delivery room.
Yeah.
And she said, yeah, she thought, you know, she didn't ask, but she assumed he was. She thought he was. And I said, you know, that's one of the reasons I have fictional children is I'll never have to be in a delivery room. There's no way, and nor should you. Why does the? My question was, and I'll put this question to you: why does the husband need to be in the delivery room? There's nothing he can do. He's not a medical professional.
No, but he wants to be there. He wants to be the first person to see his son or daughter, to see his child. You get pregnant together.
Can't you get whistled in by the doctors once the baby's out?
No.
Cleaned up, polished off a little bit? Gets the goo off?
Once I cut the cord? Sometimes the dad actually helped the doctor cut the cord.
Well, you can, again, whistle dad in to cut the umbilical cord, fine.
Was the baby taken out the sunroof, or was it born naturally?
I don't know. I didn't ask those questions.
That's huge. But because sometimes if you have a C-section now, they don't allow you to be in there. Where before, after 2003, because of malpractice issues, they don't let you film C-sections, videotape them.
I concede that.
It's like a horror movie. I could show you mine. It's a
Please do not. I concede my ignorance on the topic. Does anybody, any man really want to be in there? Or do they feel like they're duty bound to be in there? There's a big difference.
Be in there.
Was your ex-husband in the delivery room both times?
So the first time, yes. The second time, no.
What happened the second time?
Yeah.
Called off to war?
No, I punched the anesthesiologist. Oops. Sorry. I had apologized the day after.
What does that have to do with your husband being
He was like, I don't want to be a part of any of this. No, because they had to knock me out because the epidural wasn't working. So then I had to be put down, but I couldn't breathe. So I said, doctor, knock me out already. And then I punched him.
I mean, I'd be willing to witness it much like behind bulletproof glass, much like you watch an execution. But
when you get a C-section, they take your organs out and place them on your
body.
And you feel, and then they take the uterus out, they cut it. They take the baby out.
So who wants
a bloody mess? And they sew it back up, stick it back in,
okay,
stick
Rosemary's
back in top
of
it.
So
and zip you back up.
Who wants to be in the room to see that? What husband wants to see all of that? My friend said to me, "Well, if you weren't, you know, or he wasn't in the room, he would never have sex with his wife again." And I said, "If he saw what happened, he'd never want to have sex with his wife again." I assume. That's my perspective.
Everything heals. Just know that some takes some time, but.
Lucy in Lowell, Indiana, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
You were kind of getting to the point that I had. I'm the second oldest of 10 kids. My father didn't go into the delivery room, but if he would have, he would have appreciated the amount of work and effort and pain that the woman goes through. I think it would build the relationship because he would see how much she goes through to have children for him.
Yeah, all right. Thanks for the call, Lucy. So stipulated. Can't I just stay in the waiting room and hand out cigars? That's my question.
No, times have changed.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. We talked a little bit yesterday about Peter Thiel, his interview with Maria Bartiromo over the weekend. He also has given a more extensive interview the German magazine that's very good, covers a wider range of topics. But Thiel talking about why he's leaving Silicon Valley for L.A. and talking about the downside of the network effect that helped propel Silicon Valley to be the incubator of all these great tech companies. The idea that kind of people and resources are together in the same physical space, the same ecosystem, and it provides for real interconnectedness and everybody knowing everybody very well. But the downside is that everybody starts to think the same. And he argues that Silicon Valley has gone from being a liberal place to a totalitarian space where dissent is essentially not tolerated, at least not without consequence. And I suggested you could apply that same analysis to the D.C. press corps. You could also apply it to particular voter demographics, though that's changing and that's encouraging. It's anecdotal largely, but you see younger black families rethinking their allegiance to the Democrat Party. and some of the anecdotes and the conversion stories in this walkaway movement that started, this hashtag walkaway that started online, that like DC hairstylist, have been pretty interesting. This is a good one. Jesse Waters got on Fox. He's this gentleman's name is Rob Smith, an African-American gay military veteran. And listen to what Smith said in terms of what sort of brought him to his tipping point with respect to affiliating with the Democratic Party.
I think that for me, I got so sick of the lies, specifically what they were telling black people. So when you're a black person and you get these messages from Democrats, it says that you are a victim. It says that you need us to succeed. You need us to achieve. You need this ever expanding welfare state to be able to make something of yourself. And for me, I got so tired of it. And I got sick of that message that I needed them. And I got sick of that message of victimhood that they continue to push to black Americans over and over and over again for the last three decades of my life. So what they want to do is they want to keep people in line. I think Democrats use identity politics to keep people in line, to keep black people in line, to keep Latinos in line, to keep gay people in line. I'm black and gay, and I've seen them use the same tactics for black people as they do for gay people.
And when he came out as Republican?
I never lost. I didn't lose friends when I came out as gay. I've lost friends since coming out as a Republican.
Really?
People do not understand it. And these are the left that's supposed to be so tolerant and so inclusive, you know, and these are the people that were the first to shun me when I came out as conservative.
Will you?
And the operative question that Rob Smith asks rhetorically, but perhaps more will ask.
Why can't I have different ideas? Why can't I be free thinking? Why can't I have a victor mentality? Why do all of these things that I'm thinking of that I think could benefit me and other people that look like me, it doesn't always have something to do with white people. It could just be that there are different ideas that I'm connecting to more.
For more on this topic in the context of Trump economic policies that are colorblind in terms of impact and so are generating allegiance from perhaps non-traditional Republican quarters, we're pleased to be joined by Ken Blackwell, former Ohio Secretary of State and a former domestic policy advisor to the Trump transition team. Ken, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
It's good to be with you both. That was a fascinating, fascinating interview, and it showed me that more and more people, regardless of gender or color, are really willing to take a risk in a growth economy. You know, the old baseball player, Sasha Page, once said, it's damn difficult to steal second base if you want to keep one foot on first base. And so, you know, what you see more and more people saying is that I'm going to take a risk. I'm going to go for the gusto. And that only happens in a growing economy. And the president has put us on a different path. He hasn't just tinkered with the economy. He has grown it very rapidly because he's put us on a growth path with his, you know, cutting through red tape and reducing onerous regulations, cutting taxes. And this is an entrepreneur who understands that capital seeks the path of least resistance and greatest opportunity. And we had trillions of dollars sitting offshore because we had, you know, just a crazy tax scheme. We had, again, onerous regulations, and we were trying to build a welfare state as opposed to an opportunity society. And once we get on that different path of creating an opportunity society, you're going to see more and more Latinos, blacks, gays, you name it, you know, putting on that jersey and saying, I want opportunity.
Now, Ken, Satchel Paige, since you invoked him, also said that age is a question of mind over matter. If you don't mind, it doesn't matter. I have not found that to be true. I don't know how you feel about aging.
Well, at almost 71, I think Satchel has something.
Okay, all right, very good.
Now, there's news this morning that President Trump may have a second round of tax cuts, but it would only benefit the top 1%. Are you familiar with this new plan?
Well, look, what we know about the first go around is that it benefited not in terms of the tax structure, he didn't bring that top rate down as low as he wanted to. I think tax reform 2.0 is going to not just be zeroed in on the upper income bracket, but I would imagine that they will benefit substantially since most small businesses are LLCs, and therefore, you know, when you start to bring their rate down, they start to do what everyone else has done, and that is to invest more in our economy and in their workforce. And we know that most of the jobs that are created are created by companies that hire 20 and 50 and 100 and 150 people, you know, not major corporations who have become more globalist in their orientation. So tax reform 2.0 is a fix, an attempt to substantially change our tax structure where everybody will benefit and put, you know, opportunity on every branch of the American economic tree.
Now, Larry Kudlow was on over the weekend on Face the Nation, and he talked about the GDP number that was announced on Friday, of course, and that he made the point that, you know, the war on success is over, the war on business is over. And you're a policy guy, but you were also a former elected official, so you know the messaging piece of this discussion as well in the context of a political campaign. We're less than 100 days from the midterms. How important is that part of the message to rinse and repeat over the next 100 days, that the war on success, the war on business that predated the Trump administration is over, and it's producing these results, and it's generating more take-home pay and all of the benefits of entrepreneurial capitalism?
Well, I think it is very, very important. Look, our culture was rapidly becoming one where earning money didn't entitle you to it, but wanting money did. And the president has changed their paradigm. And I think that's what, you know, conservatives, you know, pro-capital, pro-market, free market candidates, Republicans have to go out and run on. They have to run on the politics of addition and multiplication, not the politics of the left, which is, you know, the politics of subtraction and division. And if they do that, I call it Jack Kemp happy talk. And if they do that, they will win.
And so,
if in fact, they retreat, you know, to the politics of, you know, subtraction and division, if they embrace a status quo that most Americans understood was not working, they will lose.
So hope, growth, and opportunity on the one side, but then how do you message with respect to what the other side is doing? How would you tackle the, you know, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Bernie Sanders socialism crowd?
Well, I would basically ask those folks to show us where an authoritarian, totalitarian, or big welfare state has succeeded at the pace of inclusion and general growth and opportunity as our free market system has. Look, in 240-plus years, America has become the most prosperous, the most ethnically diverse country in all of human history. You can prove it out in every statistic. If folks want to choose the path of Venezuela, go that way. But if, in fact, they want to stay on the path of expanding economic opportunity and work, then they'll understand that they need to look at the facts and not the fantasy that's been perpetuated by, you know, some of these far leftists who have utilitarian other sort of dreams.
Now, Mr. Blackwell, the midterm elections are 98 days away. Are you concerned that the House is going to flip into Democratic hands?
Well, the House... Well, the House will flip if, in fact, they don't stay on the same page with the president. At the end of the day, what we're up against in this midterm election is base intensity. The left is running on, again, division, hate, envy, and they are ginning up their base. We can't let our base just be satisfied with hearing our messaging of our economy is growing. We must tell them that if they don't come out and the left wins, they will not just impeach the president, they will stop, they will change the narrative. They will change the path and put us back on a path of slow growth and division. And the only thing that will be growing is the welfare state. And what we know throughout examining all of history, that whether it's a totalitarian or authoritarian or big welfare state, there are two things that they do. They, in fact, destroy and weaken the family because that builds more dependency on the government. And we know that the family in our culture has been the incubator of liberty. And they silence the church in those other forms of government because they want folks to believe that their freedom and fundamental human rights don't come from a higher power. They come from a bigger government. And when they do those things, they in fact, put folks on a path of serfdom as opposed to free thinking and opportunity seeking citizens.
That's quite a range. Satchel Paige to Frederick Hayek. That's very impressive. He is Ken Blackwell, former Ohio Secretary of State and domestic policy advisor to the Trump transition team. His recent column, Unleashing America's Entrepreneurial Spirit. Ken Blackwell, thanks as always for joining us. Real pleasure. Appreciate
it. Good to be with you both.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
This is an incredible story a cautionary tale about the online world. Monica Glennon lived in Huntsville, Alabama for the last 12 years. She's blonde, husband is a veteran of the Marine Corps, two children, and both joined the military as adults. She sells houses. She's a RE/MAX real estate agent.
Okay.
Then in September of 2015, she was plunged into a nightmare. She got a call at 6 a.m. one morning from a colleague at RE/MAX telling her something terrible had been posted about her on the RE/MAX Facebook page. The post was a claim that she and the poster's husband had an affair. The poster and her husband used Glennon as their realtor. Everything was going great until one evening she walked in on Glennon having sex with her husband on the floor of a home the couple had been scheduled to see. The unnamed poster went into graphic detail, claimed she had taken photos, so on and so forth. So the story is totally fabricated. Completely fabricated.
Pictures, though, too?
The claims.
Claims.
And there are these sites like She's a Homewrecker that will reprint these allegations without real corroboration. She had no idea why someone wrote it. She started to, write. She wrote a response saying this is completely fabricated. It's not true. I was looking at every person and in my life, every stranger wondering who did it to me and why. It makes you rethink every relationship in your life. Eventually, after $100,000 in attorney's bills, Glennon was able to unmask the culprit. It turned out to be a complete stranger who was offended by a comment Glennon had made about a news article on Facebook.
That's why some people stay completely off Facebook.
This was a response. There was a teenager who took a selfie at the Auschwitz concentration camp smiling.
Yeah.
And, do you think that's appropriate kind of discussion online? And Glennon, the victim in this case, defended the teen just basically saying, kids make mistakes.
Right. It's a youthful indiscretion.
And a woman who's unmasked, Molly Rosenblum, who's the one who manufactured the story about Glennon, researched Glennon and concocted this story She's a Homewrecker, other sites, so you're forever chasing this fabrication about yourself.
That's what you need, reputationdefender.com. Did she have to pay any?
Ultimately, she apologized.
Oh, okay. That makes it better.
They met. They met at a restaurant in Athens, Alabama, a town an hour from Glennon's, where this woman, Molly Rosenblum, Bloom, lives.
So she could slip her a roofie?
She thought I was this rich, mean person. That's the problem with social media. You just make assumptions about people. After meeting me, she did an affidavit admitting everything she did. She understood who I was then. She also, apparently, this Rosenblum had been going through, like, drug addiction and other personal issues in her life at the time, and I guess used Glennon as a, you know, a whipping person to take all of her problems out on. By the way, Rosenblum, just speaking of that, she's been sentenced to 4 years for kidnapping. Yeah. And she starts her term in November of 2017.
What'd she do?
Kidnapped somebody, apparently.
Yeah.
Unrelated. But it's just wild. This is just a wild, this, I mean, just completely fabricated story. And if you read that story on Facebook or online, one of these websites about somebody, of course you're going to give, most people would default to believing the salacious because people want to believe the salacious about other people. But perhaps this is a bit of a cautionary tale to exercise some restraint when it comes to unsubstantiated allegations made by people that could be using a dummy profile on social media or elsewhere. You've been subject to such salacious allegations. I have as well. And
oh, yeah. Remember that crazy lady who said you had
the point is that, yeah, the point is.
Well, the point is, Abraham, don't believe everything you read on the internet.
As Abraham Lincoln famously said.
Exactly.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Let freedom ring this afternoon at 2 with Sean Hannity. Right before Joe Walsh at 5 on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy, and the flight from Illinois. Property taxes being a proximate cause for many. This post from J.C. Mayfield on Facebook came to my attention. My wife and I checked into a motel for our last night as Illinois residents. This was over the weekend. We packed and are moving to Missouri because it's closer to some family, further from some, and mutually inconvenient to all.
Hey, I see what they did there.
Yeah, we will live in a nicer home, and our annual property tax bill will be the same as I have been paying just for the Homeowners Association in Sycamore.
Oh, my gosh.
And then
property taxes are awesome in Missouri.
Then he had some very nice things to say about me and the show. And,
oh, and me. Enough about me. What do you think of me?
And he said he's going to listen to us online, continue listening
listen
to us.
Listen to you online.
He said... When I was young, people were leaving Amarillo, Texas, in droves.
Amarillo,
Texas.
Why were they leaving Amarillo?
Someone purchased billboards and put out the message: "Will the last person leaving Amarillo please turn out the lights?" Illinois is not Amarillo in 1960, but wise people are leaving the state in droves. So now it's my turn to modify the phrase and say, "Will the last person leaving Illinois please turn out the lights," sort of a sad commentary, obviously. Again, the biggest indictment, people leaving who don't want to leave. Which brings us to our latest regional update of property taxes, doing these in suburban Cook and the Collar, Chicago Metro. We'll do some downstate to central and southern Illinois case studies as well. This is Kane County. We did Lake County last week. The owners of this West Dundee home, Srini Donpudi, was working as a wireless software engineer at Motorola in March of 2004 when he and his wife, Hema, bought a brand-new 3,400-square-foot, five-bedroom, red-brick Georgian with a three-car garage in West Dundee for $474,000. 2004. $474,000. $632,000 in today's dollars, adjusted for inflation. Its tax bill in 2004 was $7,300, about 1.5% of value. Last year, it had risen 67% to $12,000. 3.7% of the price the Dunpooties received for the home when they finally sold it just recently, July 25th. Sold it for $331,000. They bought for $474,000 in 2004. They sold for $331,000 in 2018. Along the way, those 14 years, they paid $150,000 in property taxes. An investment, a homestead, or an anchor? In Illinois, a home is an anchor.
Cause, it's around your neck.
Because you don't, you're under the illusion that you own it, when in point of fact, you're renting it from the government. It is collateral for somebody else's pension, and it is being diluted day after day by government. I mean, I don't know what it is that people don't see. I guess just people don't hear. The median, just looking at median home sale prices and tax rates in a sampling of communities in Kane County. Again, looking January, June 2018 home sales, median prices, median taxes. West Dundee, where the Dunpooties recently sold, median home price, $220,000. Median tax, $7,100. That's 3.27% of home value. Again, more than three times the national average. Remember, next door in Indiana, capped at no more than 1% of home value is your residential property tax bill.
Even California capped property taxes. Can you imagine if they weren't? Because there's a lot of mansions there.
Maple Park, West Dundee, Tanner Woods, Algonquin, Sugar Grove, Pingree Grove, all at 3% of home value or greater. And then you've got another dozen communities that are 2.5% or greater. Destroying home value. Eating away at home equity. And you're seeing people get hammered. I mean, the Dunpooties in West Dundee, effective, you know, constant dollars, $632 14 years ago, $331. So you lost half more while paying $150,000 in property taxes on top of it over 14 years. And if you look at these median home sale prices, you compare them 17 over 18 in a number of communities in Kane County, you're seeing negative returns. You're seeing negative returns generally. You're also seeing a declining median home sale price because that's the way this has to go as spend continues to go up at a 45-degree angle and thus property taxes as the revenue source for the spend, local government, school districts in particular, in the suburbs, go up at 45 Greengill as well. First 6 months of 2017 versus 2018, median home sale price is down, real dollars, in South Elgin, in Sleepy Hollow, in Sugar Grove, in Rainbow Hills, in West Dundee, in Maple Park. This is supposed to be a boom market, right? We're still recovering from the 2008 recession. Tanner Woods, Novak Park, Big Rock, Burlington, Five Island Park, Wild Rose, Caneville, all negatives, and some substantially. Now, there's also, too, this is somewhat anecdotal because there's in some of these communities, there's only a handful of home sales over the comparative periods, but you get the point. It's sort of inescapable. And it's a state problem. There's a good piece by Ted Dabrowski in WirePoints.com explaining why Illinois mayors have little control over pension costs. For decades, Illinois has prided itself on being a local control state. Local control, you know, authority closest to the people, subsidiarity, authority for policy decisions down to the lowest level of government. The reality is just the opposite. And nowhere is this more evident than in the state laws mandating pension benefits for police and firemen across Illinois, for example. Police and firemen, those are local employees. So there should be a local control issue, ostensibly, right? The problem is state lawmakers impose one-size-fits-all government benefits, and local governments, meaning local residents, have no choice but to pay them. For some cities, that's bringing on bankruptcy. We talked about Harvey with massive layoffs of police officers. We've talked about North Chicago going the same way, and there are dozens and dozens and dozens of suburbs right behind them. Danville's pension funding levels have collapsed to levels that make them virtually insolvent. The police pension fund in 2016 had just 30 cents of every dollar it needs to ensure it can meet its future obligations. You know who else is in that same position? Actually, a little bit worse.
Who?
City of Chicago police pension. Here's Danville. Here's what's happening, just to give you a sense of it. A retirement security for Danville workers. Again, just a case study here. The IMRF, Municipal Retired Workers Fund, 102% funded in 06, 72% funded in 16. Police went from 40 to 30. Firefighters in Danville from 30 to 17% funded. Wow. 17% funded. When you, those are unrecoverable funding levels.
Then what are they going to do?
Unretrievable debt.
Or are the checks just going to bounce?
Well, this is the great question. What happens when
there's no more money?
The fund capsizes. You can't pay out current beneficiaries. Do you liquidate people's homes at a faster pace to just buy yourself more time? Do you tell pensioners, here's an IOU, so sorry, but we don't have money? You can litigate the matter, and then pensioners are without the pension checks, which they had, which they were relying on for their retirement, and they have to litigate the matter, and a bankruptcy court judge settles it. That's where this is going, because there's no political will, and that starts with the electorate, to do anything other than careen over the edge. And I just ask the question, your pension, your home, or your job, which one are you going to give up? Because one is going, or more, will be taken from you by your government. That is going to happen. It's happening, actually. It's happening. It's just going to increase in pace. It may reach such a pace that you actually pay attention and you see it unfolding before your very eyes, rather than just be shocked when you try to go to get out from underneath your home. Steve in Winfield, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I just want to talk about your property tax thing where you were saying that some places they're like 3 or 3.5% of the value or whatever.
Yeah.
I've got a rental house in Park Forest, South Suburb.
Yeah.
That I had it on the market recently for $49,000 and it never sold. And my property taxes there are something like $5,500. We're 11% of the price it wouldn't sell for.
So, yeah, I mean, anyway. Thanks for the call, Steve.
All right, thank you.
That's what's happened in the. I know that's what's happened in the Southland generally. It's been destroyed by property taxes. You've destroyed those South Suburban communities through property taxation. Exactly what Steve is talking about. These examples, 10% and 11% of home value. And, of course, property taxes are the most confiscatory in the poorest neighborhoods because Chicago Democrats and this political ruling class that lords over Illinois, all the property tax appeals attorneys, the Mike Madigans and the Rob Martwicks, they care about you so much. They care about the poor. They care about middle-income families so much. They want you to make sure that you get a return on the investment you've made in Illinois by buying a home here because they care about you so much. And it's a wake-up call. If there's ever going to be one, I suppose. Ralph and Rantoul.
Yeah, good morning. I have an acquaintance who spent almost 20 years as the finance director of one of the largest cities in Illinois, not Chicago. And we used to go round and round and round because that city would always need more money for spending and they would issue bonds. And for the people out there who don't know, bond is basically a business loan, okay? It's a loan. So loans have interest payments and payment of principal that has to eventually be paid.
That's treated as revenue in this state.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And we used to talk all the time, and I had odds constantly. I said, you know, it's a spending problem. The more you spend, the more you borrow, and it increases the cost of living for all the people in your city, and it also warps the way they vote. And I think that's why the voters of Illinois are so brainwashed into the system, because all they know is the promises, the buying of the votes by the politicians for the inflated pension funds, get as many government workers as possible in unions so you can enslave them to promises of pension funds. And it's worse and worse and worse. I don't know how Illinois is going to get out of it. It's not affordable. They can't even pay the interest payments on the unfunded pension liability with this current state budget. There's not enough money there to go. The only way it's going to be solvable is if some of that liability is discharged. That's going to be like a firestorm.
Thanks for the call, Ralph. Eddie in Orland Park.
Hey, good morning.
Morning.
Hi.
I was talking, you're talking about property, residential property taxes. The commercial property taxes in this state is ridiculous.
Yeah.
I have a building in Blue Island that's worth maybe $375,000. My tax bill, $47,000.
Oh, my gosh. That's highway robbery.
It's a taking.
Amy,
it's a taking. Yeah, it's the government confiscating your property. They just they just do it through taxation.
And it's $47,000 after I fought it. So now I have to pay my real estate attorney. I have to pay the appraiser, and I get no savings. And it's just unbelievable. This state is crazy.
Well, right. Thanks for the call, Eddie. I mean, in Blue Island again. We're talking about the Southland. My majority minority communities, stripped of industry. And now stripped of home ownership and being forcibly treated as payday loan recipients at best. That's what that is. Sean in Elmwood Park.
You know, not only is Eddie right, I'm actually going this morning to look at a commercial piece that I can't believe how low the price is. I'm taking a client there. But he's exactly right about the taxes. But here's what he's not telling you. The only ones buying the commercial are the villages themselves. So do you understand that means you, the people, are buying it? So you're paying the taxes, and they pretend that those taxes are being paid. That's why they keep going up on the non-government-owned property. You're living through the implosion of fraud, of their own failure. So they're trying to hide all these little municipalities, especially the ones where the villages are a little bit smarter than the average bear. They know not to create a panic. They buy it, and that's why you see these parking lots pop up out of nowhere. So now you've got a building, a parking lot, that was paying $80,000, $60,000 in taxes, paying nothing. But here's the other thing, Prof, that I love that nobody talks about. Whenever you hire one of these Irish wannabe mobsters with their drunken pinstripe suits, your taxes get lowered. Poof, it's like magic. You mean I hire Eddie Burke and my taxes go down? Doesn't that really tell you that they know their taxes are wrong in the beginning? Not only that, it's automated. You could tell within a split second what the value of property is per foot.
As long as
they won't do it.
As long as they get their cut, right, Sean? Thanks for the call.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Are we marking a real turning point in American history with Trump-era prosperity, as evidenced by the GDP number announced on Friday, 4.1%, as well as tracking for 3% growth this year, confounding all of the experts who thought that Trump would tank the market and tank the economy were he to be elected president.
And I like my paycheck, don't you?
I like any paycheck. Yeah.
Every other Friday is a good day.
That's right. Also, remember the new normal under Obama and to some extent Bush was to be anemic growth because we're a declining power. Well, that feeling has somewhat changed. Larry Kudlow certainly is a hope growth and opportunity optimist, and he explained his view on the GDP number, its import, on Face the Nation over the weekend.
The basics of this number were consumer spending and business investment. Those are the basics of any number, C plus I, to put it in economic terms. It's doing terrific. It's rising by better than 4%, as was the overall. And I know some people have tried to downgrade this by saying about the tariffs, buy ahead of tariffs. By the way, we don't know that. There's a lot of theories about that. I'm glad to see exports rising, whatever the reason. The biggest thing that nobody's talked about in terms of these smaller issues is inventories. Inventories fell by, I think, $25 billion. That's very unusual. Mm. It took at least a percentage point off of GDP. But these things jump around a lot. The heart of this report, as I said, consumer spending, business investment are on a tear. Business investment is on a tear, which was really what our tax cuts were designed
right.
to do.
And your deregulation.
The deregulation, thank you, and the energy. And by the way, the president's attitude, the war against business is over, the war against success is over, the war
but
against
energy is
over.
But then he's got a trade war.
Now, on the other side, David Brooks, a Trump skeptic, while he conceded that the president gets credit for a good number, presidents get credit when the economy is doing well and they get blamed when it's not. But he suggested there are two tracks that are problematic with Trump when it comes to the economy and pretty much everything else.
You notice two things when people from talking with people, especially in the business community from around the world. The first is the U.S. is now becoming like this black hole. That they just don't want to get involved. And there are plenty of ways to invest in China. There's plenty of ways to invest in Africa or Europe or Asia. So why get involved in the U.S.? And as a result, foreign direct investment is plummeting here.
You mean because of the controversy?
They just don't want to be involved with Trump. Yeah. They just don't want to be involved. And they get the sense that America is no longer the central nation. It's the dynamism is elsewhere. The U.S. is imploding. And so we should be seeing surges of people wanting to invest here. Our economy is doing pretty good. But we're not seeing that. And second, you see this pattern of Trump, and we saw it with the EU this week, where he'll make an attack and then he'll sort of backtrack and have a sort of peace deal. And that's sort of the drama that he likes. But it means that you can never count on him. I mean, if he does something good or do something bad, there's always going to be a backtrack. So there's just permanent instability in the U.S. presidency.
To reconcile these conflicting opinions, we're pleased to be joined by our friend, the Godfather. He is Rick Santelli, CNBC contributor, on-air editor for CNBC. Rick, thanks again for joining us. Appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure, Dan.
So trying to reconcile some of what David Brooks said, he's right, foreign direct investment here is down year over year, but don't tell Masa-san at SoftBank, who invested $70 billion here, that. Is Brooks's channeling of the foreign investors' view of the United States correct?
Well, I'll tell you what, he brings up good points. I'm just not sure about his math, because I think indirectly one of the big issues, of course, is China. And for 2016, China's direct investment into the U.S. was about $40 billion. Last year, it drifted down to about $39.5 billion. We don't have 2018 figures yet. And just to put that in perspective, last year, Canada's direct investment was $72 billion. So, double basically China's. And the only reason I bring that up is that foreign direct investment by many countries actually continues to ramp up, whether it's the Middle East or parts of Europe, the Netherlands specifically. So I'm not sure that David Brooks is accurate in that. It certainly seems like a layup to say. And I also think that with respect to my ex-peer who used to work with us, Larry Kudlow, also said some things that I would have to point out. I have a slightly different take on. The fact of the matter is, Dan, that when businesses globally sense that something is afoot, particularly trade negotiations, I wouldn't definitely not call it a trade war, while this is going on, they step up various activities. So I do think that the ramp up in exports is probably kind of to beat some of the tariffs by some of the local exporters, and I think the inventory numbers falling may represent that as well. Now, Larry's right, it's hard to quantify, but I certainly think that the big things in the economy don't happen coincidentally, and I think the timing augurs that there's a relationship between the tariffs and businesses trying to get ahead of them or mitigate the, some of the pressures best they can.
Well, what about the American farmer? I mean, they're already talking about subsidies of $12 billion that they'll hand out in September. Do you feel bad for them? Are they really struggling?
You know, I'll tell you, Amy, that is the toughest one of all, and I always have to pick my words very carefully because in a past life I did quite a bit of activity and trading and consulting with various agricultural groups. One of my operations was very heavily involved in agricultural trading. The point is that if you take a step back in the big picture and you look at global demand, for example, for soybeans, then you look at global supply for soybeans, what you would find is that they're pretty evenly matched. There's huge demand in the globe. So what we're really doing is rearranging whose soybeans go to who. So if somebody switches out the U.S. because they have a beef with us like China, we'll just play musical chairs. And whatever those beans come from now, they're obviously being taken from another customer that will become our customer. So I don't know that it's as horrible as it's made out to be. Now, granted, if you're a bean farmer, you want to know as your field starts to grow and you see all your money invested start sprouting and maturing that it's going to have an export home, and that home may be in question, but only in question as to the destination. It's going to be sold. There's demand. And I think the $12 billion, there's definitely a little politics in that because the government has so many programs that could help in this regard that were already established.
Sticking with China, which is largely what we're talking about when we talk about soybeans and some ag products, there's an interesting piece. You know, we always look at this complicated relationship from the U.S. perspective. What about the Chinese perspective and perhaps some missteps they have made that could be to our benefit? There's a really interesting piece in the South China Morning Post about essentially arguing that Beijing got Trump wrong. They thought that his attitude towards China with respect to tariffs and fair trade, I guess, to borrow a phrase, was a bluff. And now they don't think it's so much a bluff. They talk about, do the authors of this piece, which shouldn't come as a surprise to us, but that there are very few people that will tell Beijing no. And so they sort of are in their own bubble. They discourage policy advisors from having in-depth discussions with their U.S. counterparts. And so that has led to a misunderstanding or an ignorance of the latest thinking in Washington. And I just wonder if the Trump calling the China's bluff on this topic, you know, may generate what Larry Kudlow suggests, which is ultimately in the medium term, we get to a lower tariff environment or we get to an escalating trade negotiation that metastasizes into a war. I mean, where are you in terms of the feel for which direction this is going?
Well, I think if there's a category for those who misunderstand this president, whether individuals, companies, or countries, that list is much longer than just China, that's
yeah,
for sure.
Yeah.
And when it comes to your question directly, my own feeling is that this is a, if it turns into more of a skirmish slash war with regard to trade, there's no doubt in anybody's mind who will win. So when you hear many pundits say nobody wins a trade war, I'm not sure that that's particularly true. It does represent some truth insofar as both sides will lose some activity, just like when a company or workers go on strike. But the eventual prize will go to the U.S. just by the sheer numbers of how little exports from other countries imported into our country affect our economy. We're still the main consumption-driven economy in the world, which means anywhere from two-thirds to a higher percentage of our economic activity is our own consumption with regard to we're not an export economy like Germany, like China, which is a big chunk of their GDP. So we will win this. It's just a matter of how long it takes and how much pain in various sectors it inflicts and how that pain maybe translates into changing political landscape.
As you look ahead at the next 24 months, what are the areas of greatest concern to you in terms of the stability or the growth potential of the U.S. economy? Is it a particular debt load in a sector, like, say, the public sector or student loan? Is it re-blowing up the housing bubble? What concerns you?
You know, Dan, all those are definitely turnstiles of some worry beads. But without a doubt, the top of the mountain worry in my mind, and I never take my eye off the ball, these other issues come and go, and I'm not dismissing them. They're all important. But how central banks reverse a decade of very strange, one-off, first-time-ever-seen policy, like the Bank of Japan owning a good chunk of all the companies in their economy and their major stock indices, owning securities, central banks like ours having huge inventory of securities, all the programs to control interest rates, manage interest rates, manipulate interest rates. All this is starting to get unwound. Our central bank is way ahead of the pack in that regard. And by the way, today's the first day of a two-day Federal Open Market Committee meeting, our central bank. But that's what worries me the most. This has been the grandest experiment of monetary policy of all time, and we have no idea exactly how it's going to end or the unintended consequences we'll experience as this starts to peel back the onion of a decade worth of stimulus post-crisis.
He's the Godfather, on-air editor for CNBC, Rick Santelli. Rick, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate your insights.
My pleasure, Dan. Thank you.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
So you've been to suburban North Lake, right?
Oh, lovely community.
It is.
Particularly this time of year.
One thing that stands out, and it was a life-size statue of an elephant that has been there for about 40 years, and something happened to the elephant. Somebody set the elephant on fire. The weird part is the elephant's name is Broccoli, and I have no idea why that would have been the first question I would have asked as a reporter.
Broccoli seared a little bit.
Oh, it's completely destroyed. There's surveillance video. Tim Sanger, the owner, was on vacation.
We didn't understand. I didn't know if it was lightning or firework. Vandalism was the last thing on my mind, to be honest.
Because I came home and it was nothing but rubble. I mean, you got to see the video of this. You can see the arsonist. He tried first time to set broccoli on fire, and then he came back a second time, and everyone's upset.
To see that somebody would do this, it's so heartbreaking.
To the whole family, it was just kind of like the town mascot, you know?
Yeah, welcome to Illinois, the roving bands of Malcolm McDowell and his Clockwork Orange friends.
Cook County Sheriff's Police are investigating.
Who would want to torch the elephant?
We're at a loss. I have no idea. We don't have enemies that we're aware of. We're pretty decent people, we think. You know, we are at a loss.
Yeah, I mean, somebody disagrees.
Wait till you see a picture. I mean, it's a suburban, you know, track housing, and then there's this huge life-size elephant that's been there forever.
First,
the mascot of the town.
First, the spindle is removed from Berwyn, and now Broccoli the elephant from North Lake.
Just
not that many tourist attractions in West Central Cook County anymore.
Take a look at the surveillance video. If you know anything about it, you're asked to call police. I'm Cook County Sheriff's Department.
Yeah. The Cook County Sheriff's Department will get right on that after Tom Dart's next puppy rescue.
Maybe they can call the Forest Preserve Police to help out.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy continues now. And make sure to stay tuned to catch me, Mike Gallagher, coming up at 9, only on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Employers abandoning preferences for college degrees and specific skill sets to speed up hiring and broaden the pool of job candidates. No experience necessary. We'll train is the clarion call in certain industries that have more job openings than job applicants.
We even have a live read for PermaSeal saying that they're looking for customer service. They're looking for any applicants, even, you know, waterproofing. We'll teach you if you're willing to learn.
So does that mean the gap between elites like you, Amy, media elites.
Exactly.
And Johnny Punch Clocks like me, regular folk, simple rural folk like me.
It's the other way around, but okay. What
is
does
that
mean?
Is that gap narrowing? This was part of the discussion. Mike Rowe, you know Mike Rowe.
Oh, I love
Discovery
Mike Rowe.
Discovery Channel, Dirty Jobs, one of my favorite shows, Deadliest Catch, narrator. Mike Rowe had with Ben Shapiro, the gap between the elites and the hoi polloi, is that narrowing? Can it ever narrow? What's the takeaway that we should understand in terms of the gap and how it can be narrowed in some important way?
Well, there's always been a gap, right? Sometimes it's wide, sometimes it's less wide. And we all fall in love with the romantic version of ourselves, right? Whether you're a journalist or whether you're an actor, whether whatever it is you think you are and whoever it is you think you are, that becomes, you become the sun in your own solar system. So you, everything else is just a planet in orbit, right? So I think with regard to the skills gap and regard to really any gap, it's all just symptomatic of a series of what I would call disconnects. We've become slowly and inexorably and profoundly disconnected from a lot of very basic things that when I grew up, I was really connected to, like where my food comes from, where my energy comes from, basic history, basic curiosity, you know, the things that fundamentally allow us to assume a level of appreciation that, in my view, is the best way to bridge those gaps. If we don't have appreciation.
Appreciation is the key. Let's get the take of another cultural maven, an elite. He's the senior editor for TheFederalist.com, author of the book First Freedom, A Ride Through America's Enduring History with the Gun from the Revolution to Today. David Harsanyi, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Always a pleasure. What do you just strive to be elite.
you're a striver. What do you think about Mike Rowe's perspective on that? He always sort of has a unique take, and just the idea that just a little bit of appreciation for all that we have and what other people do and the work product of other people could go a long way in terms of narrowing some of these divides.
I think it's a good perspective. I mean, I just sort of tangentially, I was thinking about how essentially everyone today is living in the best time that has ever existed in the history of mankind and is constantly complaining about how terrible everything is. And I think that sort of thing seeps into the mind. Now, you know, I don't know that young people can really compare or live their lives comparing it to some other time. I don't think it works that way. But we should have some perspective on what's going on, and I think we're missing that. We don't really appreciate much of it.
Since you wrote a book about history with the gun recently, this morning, thousands are downloading the 3D printed gun designs. How do you feel about that?
I was just reading about that. I haven't really formulated a strong opinion on it yet. I think, obviously, I want most Americans to be able to have firearms who are law-abiding, but I do wonder a little bit about... And also, I have this perspective that I don't know that information should be banned. You know, instructions on how to do it are just a free speech issue. But I do wonder what happens if criminals can start doing that sort of thing and how that affects, crime and things like that. So, I'm still undecided, but, I pretty much always land on the side that allows law-abiding citizens to have firearms.
We're 98 days from midterm elections, and so there's kind of been a little bit of assessment of the landscape at this juncture going on inside the echo chambers of politics. One piece, Jay Cost over at Real Clear Politics, making the point that Trump is the problem for the GOP, not because he hasn't advanced the conservative reform agenda, because in a lot of material ways he has, but because of his personal conduct, that people want the president to behave in a way they've come to expect as presidential. And Trump obviously doesn't conform to that norm, as he doesn't conform to so many others, some of which have been very productive that he hasn't conformed. But this one is a political problem that is going to redound down ballot and is perhaps the key challenge that House Republicans face in terms of control.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it depends where you're looking in the country. In certain places, I think that is a big problem. Elsewhere, I see that, you know, if you're not completely on board with Trump, that's a problem for you, you know. So it's this weird divide. But certainly this is new, right? And I don't know how it's going to play out. The midterms, first midterms of any, you know, any presidency, first term presidency, it's typically going to be ugly for the ruling party. So I think Republicans are probably, you know, not going to do well. I think the size of what, you know, of the Democratic victory, if it is, and been wrong before, you know, will tell us more about that. So, but yeah, I mean, I think it is a problem for certain people. They don't like how Donald Trump acts, even if they like sort of what he's doing in general. But these local races, sometimes that just has a lot to do with the people involved in the issues involved in, you know, in that race. So it's difficult to tell. But, yeah, I mean, to some extent, certainly, I think it's a problem.
How important is it after the last 30 days with challenges with the Trump's family separation policy combined with the performance at Helsinki? How important is it to move on the Brett Kavanaugh nomination, get the hearing scheduled, and let's get that thing going and him confirmed?
Well, I don't know how important it is as far as the election goes, the midterms go, but I think it's super important for him to get it done before, you know, potentially maybe losing the votes in the Senate to get it done at all. And I think that's why he picked Kavanaugh, because he was the most confirmable. So I think that's super important. And I think it is an issue that matters to certain people, and it's something that Republicans can campaign on. But I was, when you look at what voters care about and what we're constantly talking about, they just don't add up. You know, the voters don't really care that much about the Russian collusion stuff. Voters do care, though, about immigration. So sometimes I wonder whether the things that we get excited about in the media, online, on Twitter, wherever else, really reflects what people are thinking about. And maybe that's why we've been getting elections wrong lately, because we don't understand what people really care about. And I worry about that.
Well, speaking of collusion, President Trump's new attorney, Rudy Giuliani, has had a kind of a bizarre past 24 hours going on CNN and other shows. And he said that collusion is not a crime. Do you agree with that?
Yeah. I mean, I put it this way. I think there is collusion could be an impeachable offense, because it doesn't have to be a crime. But I'm not exactly sure that people who are constantly talking about this have defined what collusion actually looks like or means. So is meeting with a Russian lawyer who has Kremlin connections collusion? I don't know. Is getting a dossier filled with rumors that someone connected to the Kremlin came up with collusion and then using it in an election? I don't know. So I think we have to define what collusion is. I mean, I think Rudy Giuliani has been kind of all over the place and somewhat entertaining to watch, but doesn't really make much sense to me most of the time. But I'm not. I think he's right. I collusion. I think
it's not.
They asked Comey that, and Comey said it wasn't a crime. Well, there's no crime called collusion.
Right. I mean, it should point me to the collusion statute. There's criminal conspiracy statutes.
Right.
But if you want to point me to a specific criminal conspiracy statute, then let's go through the requirements to clear the threshold for that crime and assess it against the evidence that Mueller or whoever else has cobbled together so far. I mean, that's the way you do it, the way the media talks about this.
Yes.
I mean, they're ignoramuses. They don't know what the hell they're talking about.
And also confuse, like, exploitation of someone and colluding with someone. So if someone joins the NRA and tries to get close to Republican politicians, they're exploiting people they know. Now, I'm not saying I don't exactly know what that situation is going to be like in the end or what that's about. But the problem there is, you know, yeah, we have Maria Butina has done what about thousands of people do in this town all the time for foreign governments. She just didn't register to do it. You know what I'm saying? So I'm not exactly sure now, you know, what collusion is, what spying is supposed to be. And I think we need to define our terms here, because when everyone talks about collusion, it's simply just talking to some Russian. It's not a criminal. People have been doing that for a long time.
All right. Speaking of the NRA, we had a good discussion on this with our callers last week. But the NRA has weighed in on that Stand Your Ground shooting in Florida. Outside that convenience store where the guy was sort of accosting another guy's girlfriend. He comes out, pushes him to the ground. The guy puts two in his chest. And it was our take and a lot of other people's, including apparently the NRA, that is not a proper application of the standard ground law, and that Florida sheriff was wrong in Pinellas County, and that guy who shot the other guy and killed him should be charged in that case. What was your read on that situation?
I think that's right. When I lived in Colorado, there were stand your ground laws or make my day laws, and I remember there was this case where this homeless person kept sleeping in someone's garage, I think it was, and one night he just waited for the guy to come in and shot him. Now, people abuse the law. There has to be some level of interpretation here, and I think that they were wrong in Florida because clearly that didn't need to happen. I think that when you were for these sorts of laws, and I am a proponent of them, you have to be careful to make sure that you're not just, giving it blanket support when people are abusing it. So,
he is David Harsanyi, senior editor at TheFederalist.com, author of the book The First Freedom, A Ride Through America's Enduring History with the Gun from the Revolution to Today to 3D Printing, apparently. David Harsanyi, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is The Morning Show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Well, the report has been completed. A 495-page report on the missing MH370, the 777 that disappeared, the Malaysian Airlines.
Sure.
Who could
sure
forget? 239 people on board en route from Beijing to Kuala Lumpur, disappeared March 8th, 2014. And now, the report is in. This is what it concludes. That the controls on that Boeing 777 were likely deliberately manipulated to take it off course, but they were not able to determine who was responsible. Could it have been an alien that popped on board?
I think I know who it was.
Who was it?
A certain CNN anchor.
What do you mean? Oh, my girlfriend?
Who made his career on it.
What if it was hijacking or terrorism or mechanical failure or pilot error? But what if it was something fully that we don't really understand? A lot of people have been asking about black holes and on and on and on and all of these conspiracy
sure.
theories. Let's look
yeah.
at this. Noah says, what else can you think about? Black hole, Bermuda Triangle. And then Deji says, just like the movie Lost. And of course, they're also referencing the Twilight Zone, which has a very similar plot. That's what people are saying. I know it's preposterous, but is it preposterous, you think, Mary?
I know it's preposterous, but is it preposterous?
He had a time to fill.
Yeah.
I mean, they were on this for 2 weeks straight in the floor map. And
the
all
Earth would have collapsed in on itself if it were a black hole. So no, Don, I don't think it was a black hole.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.